and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tone of reconciliation expressed by Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu in his address to the annual AIPAC conference in Washington, where he was preceded by the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, who insisted that the bond between the United States and Israel is still a national commitment. Guy Ziv, a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Has Netanyahu Gone Too Far? And whether Netanyahu's controversial speech to Congress on Tuesday will be an anticlimax. Then we will speak with Nina Krusheva, a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, about her article at Project Syndicate, Kremlin Murder Incorporated, and what the U.S. and the West can do to avoid a deepening hostility and military arms race with Russia as they try to find a way to deal with Putin, who does not care what the West thinks of him, is not bothered by sanctions, and continually reminds the world that Russia is a nuclear power. Then finally, we'll examine further the real reasons behind the steep and sudden rise in the price of gas that appears to have little to do with supply and demand, since the price of crude remains below $50 a barrel. A former investment banker who spent 12 years at Goldman Sachs and Company, Wallace Turberville, joins us to discuss the direct relationship between the ability of the big banks to buy enough congressmen to overturn provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act that then enabled them to speculate in the oil futures market and gouge the American public at the pump, while the mainstream press continues to parrot fictions about refinery fires, etc., to shield the real culprits who are fleecing their fellow Americans. And joining us now is Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at American University School of International Service and the director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestine conflict. He is the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres, and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, and he has an article at CNN, Has Netanyahu Gone Too Far? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Guy Ziv.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I guess no point in asking the question again. Has Netanyahu gone too far? Your article makes it clear that he has.
Yes. I mean, the issue that Netanyahu has is a valid issue to bring up. And, as I mentioned in my piece, Netanyahu has very good reason to doubt the Iranians' intentions. Iran has a long history of deception and concealment with respect to its nuclear weapons program. And Netanyahu does have some misgivings about President Obama's approach to all of this. But having said that, to insert political dimensions to this issue, to turn to partisan politics, which is pretty much what Netanyahu has done, is outside the realm of acceptable behavior, in my considered opinion.
And this is clearly happening very close to an election. And I believe the speech that Netanyahu will give on Tuesday to the Congress has pretty much overshadowed the election issues in the campaign, which have been largely focused on pocketbook issues and on a feeling in Israel that the growing disparity between the rich and the poor has gotten out of hand. And Netanyahu, to some extent, has been in trouble, has he not, on the economic issue?
He has. There was a recent study that came out, a report that came out by the state controller blaming him for having an inordinate amount of, mishandling the housing situation, which has gotten out of hand. But I think one of his calculations in giving his speech is to move away from the focus on the housing costs and the high cost of living in general, and focus more on Iran and foreign policy, which he sees as a strength.
So in his speech to AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, of course, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu struck a very conciliatory tone, which I assume will be repeated before the Congress. Is that your expectation?
Well, it's not exactly clear what he's going to say tomorrow, because some are expecting him to deliver additional evidence that we haven't yet heard concerning the Iranian nuclear program. If he falls short of doing that, then a lot of people are going to scratch their heads and ask, so why is he doing this? What new light is he really shedding on this issue?
Well, but he's, you know, this is not the United States that he has a beef with. This is the P5 plus one, which is the permanent five members of the United Nations. That is the US, the UK, France, Russia, and China, along with Germany. That's six of the most powerful nations on the earth. These countries rarely agree on anything. So the fact that they're all in agreement that this is a deal that can be made and needs to be made really does isolate Netanyahu, doesn't it?
Maybe to some extent, but I think the issue he has is not with with these countries. The issue he has is with Iran. And I would point out to Netanyahu's credit that the IAEA issued a report a week and a half ago basically arguing that the Iranians are still stonewalling the nuclear inspectors on their basic questions concerning Iran's past involvement in nuclear activities, answers to which the Iranians have yet to questions to which the Iranians have yet to answer. So there's definitely some legitimate questions that need to be raised about this nuclear deal. We all want to make sure that if there is a nuclear deal, it's a good deal, it's a strong deal. I just have an issue with how Netanyahu is going about doing it. This is not the right venue for expressing his concerns and frustration. He can do it behind closed doors. He was offered that opportunity by senior Democratic senators with a sterling pro-Israel record, and he refused to meet with them separately.
And he met with the Republicans instead.
Well, he met, I think, with the top leadership of both parties, but he could have listened to concerns expressed by many members of Congress from the Democratic Party who felt that Speaker Boehner, in inviting Netanyahu but failing to coordinate the invitation with the White House or the State Department, was placing them in a very tough bind because they had to then make a choice of going to the to hearing his speech, but, you know, at the same time snubbing their president, or snubbing Netanyahu by not going to the speech. And that's a very precarious position to be in.
But nevertheless, the position that he's taking, condemning the P5 plus one as and their possible agreement with Iran that's getting close to being negotiated and is by no means complete, does, don't you think, implicitly it's saying that you guys are being taken in by these Iranians and I'm not. You know, you guys are suckers and I'm not.
I think Israel has a lot at stake here. Israel is perhaps the only country in the United Nations that's been threatened with destruction by Iran. So I think that there's definitely a lot of concern in Israel as to what this deal means. Will the Iranians, will this simply buy them time to build nuclear weapons? Or is this a deal that's going to actually help prevent them from doing so? And I think that's really the question that a lot of people have, including Netanyahu.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Guy Zib, who's a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, and has an article at CNN, Has Netanyahu Gone Too Far? Now, you mentioned Senator Feinstein, who appeared on the Sunday morning talk shows, and Netanyahu had turned down her offer to meet with the Democratic caucus, and I believe actually met today with the Republican caucus. But nevertheless, what she did say on the Sunday talk shows, I think, was pretty challenging to Netanyahu. She was talking about Netanyahu's speaking, you know, telling European Jews to emigrate and speaking on behalf of the Jewish people, and in the context of speaking to the Congress as well. She said that Netanyahu does not speak for the Jewish people and that it's arrogant of him to think he does.
Well, I agree with the senator. Netanyahu has said on a couple of occasions that he is representing all Jews, and that's clearly not the case. There are many Jews who disagree with him. There are many Jews in Europe who are, do not feel that they have any reason to leave their home country, their host country, or their home country, and go to Israel, which to them is not their homeland. So not everybody agrees with Netanyahu on that, and not everybody agrees with Netanyahu on the Iran issue either, for that matter.
But so does he have a sort of messianic quality here? I mean, what do you think is, I mean, obviously much of what he's doing is motivated by the election in Israel. And I recall that Henry Kissinger once said that Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, it only has domestic politics.
That's right.
And you have a very close election, unusually close, although the country itself has moved pretty far to the right, hasn't it, in the last few decades?
It's interesting because on the one hand, the public has moved to the right for sure. I mean, we've seen mostly Likud governments, right-of-center governments. At the same time, what makes it really interesting is that the polls show that more people have moved to the left on some of the issues. So, for example, 20, 25 years ago, only the left and even the far left supported the notion of a two-state solution, a Palestinian, independent Palestinian state. Today, that's a notion that's supported by the majority, a slight majority of the Israeli public. Same thing with Jerusalem. When you asked people, would you be willing to divide Jerusalem in a peace agreement, 20, 25 years ago, only the far left would even contemplate it. And today, while it's not quite a majority, you have many Israelis, including some on the right, who would be willing to consider a division of Jerusalem. So, yes, their voting pattern seems to suggest that they're more hawkish and more right-wing, but on the issues, they're more flexible today than they were 20, 25 years ago.
But on the issues that you work on, Dr. Guy Ziv, in terms of an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I know I've spoken to people over the years, going back to Yehoshaphat Hakabi, a military intelligence official, one of the first people to express the need for a two-state solution. It's always been driven by the security people because of demographics and security concerns. In effect, the security people who came up with this idea, as far as I can tell. And we've seen recently, particularly with the former head of Mossad, tremendous divide between him and Netanyahu. It feels as if Dagan is actually campaigning against Netanyahu. So is that going to impact the elections? And so, of course, Tzipi Livni is a former senior official with the Mossad.
So far, it has not seemed to have a major impact on the elections. And this is another interesting phenomenon about Israeli politics, because those on the right, including Netanyahu, including his far-right minister, Naftali Bennett, constantly berate the left for neglecting Israel's security concerns. Yet we do know that the vast majority of former heads of the Mossad, former heads of the Shin Bet, ex-generals, former heads of the IDF military intelligence, former IDF chiefs of staff, the vast majority of them are much closer to Livni and to Herzog and to the kind of left-of-center Israeli politicians than they are to Netanyahu. They call for a two-state solution, less so out of concern for human rights or Palestinian rights, and more so out of concern for Israel and Israel's future. Demographically, Israel's going to have a very big problem in the years ahead maintaining its democracy and a majority of Jews. And so this is a real necessity for Israeli security.
So has anybody really, though, challenged Netanyahu and I guess by extension, Naftali Bennett, on what their end game is vis-a-vis the Palestinians? Because that seems to be something that they kind of gloss over. They never really specify what is their end game, what kind of arrangement. It's as though, you know, much of what they are doing with expanding settlements, et cetera, is, you know, they want to change the facts on the ground. But they also seem to have this kind of wishful thinking that somehow the Palestinians are going to go away someday.
The narrative that Netanyahu has perpetuated, which is accepted now, it's become part of the mainstream in Israel, in Israeli discourse, is that there's no partner on the other side. So Netanyahu himself is on record supporting a two-state solution. I don't know whether he believes it or whether he's sincere about it. But for Netanyahu and Bennett and so many average Israelis, the idea of negotiating peace is a nice idea, but they don't see any legitimate negotiating partner at this time, somebody who really accepts Israel's right to exist. I don't buy that narrative, but that's become part of the discourse. Former President Shimon Peres recently stated it nicely, because you asked about the end game, said that he sees the difference in this election between those who support a peace agreement, a two-state solution, and those who would rather manage the conflict. So he really made a distinction between those who want to resolve the conflict and those who want to manage it. And, of course, Netanyahu is in that category, is in that camp of those who would rather manage the conflict than resolve it.
But in terms of going back to the Iran issue, which is at the heart of Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to the United States, to his speech before AIPAC on Monday and his speech before the Congress on Tuesday, is this, you know, we know that they're poised to make some kind of deal. And a lot of analysts think that the deal could be far more tectonic than just a simple agreement to get rid of nuclear weapons, or at least to curb and make the process more transparent. That in many ways you have this weird de facto alliance between the Likud and the Israeli right and the Saudis and General Sisi against the, you know, any form of political Islam, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, and against Iran. And there's essentially a proxy war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran in the region. There's an expectation that this could change things dramatically. So I've been reading stuff today from a number of people who support the talks with Iran, suggesting that what Netanyahu is more afraid of, not the existential fear that Iran's going to go to war against Israel or wipe it out with nuclear weapons, as they have many times professed, but rather that he's afraid of peace. Can you make a case that he needs the bogeyman just as much as the hardliners in Iran need death to America?
I'm not sure I agree with that, actually, and I am a critic of Netanyahu. I think Netanyahu and many others legitimately do fear Iran. The chances of Iran using nuclear weapons to bomb Israel are low, and I think Netanyahu is aware of that. But I think the key concern here is, will they have the ability with nuclear weapons to perpetuate terrorism, to continue to support Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist groups without any kind of repercussions? You know, they would be a much more stronger, more influential player in the Middle East, and there would be very little that the West could do to stop them. So I think that, and the idea of having nuclear proliferation, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states and possibly Egypt will also begin to work on that on nuclear weapons themselves. And before you know it, you have a Middle East that's going to be much less stable than it is today, which is hard to imagine. But there are some serious considerations here. Iran from going nuclear.
Sure, but presumably that's why the P5 plus one are there, isn't it? They all see that.
I think the real question is, you know, can you get a good deal, a strong deal out of this? There has been some concern, for example, that Secretary of State Kerry might be too eager for a deal. And if one is too eager for a deal, then presumably one might be able to settle for something less than the optimal outcome. And so I think the concern here is, can you get a deal which is strong, which has good verification mechanism, that allows inspectors to do their work, that allows that will ensure that Iran does not work on their plutonium processing plant, and so on and so forth. And so there are more questions than answers at this point.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Geisev, based upon Netanyahu's speech before the AIPAC conference in Washington, and he was preceded by Samantha Power, the United States' representative to the United Nations, It was all sort of a love fest and talks of conciliation and the enduring friendship that will weather any current disagreement, etc. So at the end of the day, could this whole thing be an anticlimax?
I'm not sure. I do know that the U.S.-Israel relationship rests on solid foundations. It's based on a set of common values and common interests, common strategic interests. And we've seen in the past other crises, and the U.S.-Israel relationship has endured and survived all those crises, and it probably will survive this one as well. My argument is that by giving the speech in a very partisan kind of manner, he is really taking a chance, and he's really subjecting the relationship to an unnecessary test, one with consequences that we really are not sure about yet.
Well, Dr. Geisev, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Geisev, who's a professor at the American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, and has an article at CNN, Has Netanyahu Gone Too Far? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with Nina Khrushcheva about her article, Kremlin Murder Incorporated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, where she has a new article, Kremlin Murder Incorporated. And she is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and her latest book is The Losh Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And the title of your new article, Project Syndicate, Kremlin Murder Incorporated, does seem very apt. It's pretty hard not to believe if Putin is not directly culpable, he is indirectly culpable for creating the atmosphere that allows and inspires people to kill Boris Nemtsov. But is Putin then, could you describe him as both the arsonist and the fire brigade?
Yes. That's a really very good description, because even if he's not directly involved, he's directly involved because he did create that atmosphere of lawlessness, but also great national paranoia. So somebody who thought that they're serving the Russian state by eliminating one of Putin's opponents and a pro-Ukrainian advocate, politician, Boris Nemtsov. So that's arsonist, and of course, or creating the atmosphere of arson. And of course, as the fire chief, he announced that Putin announced that he's going to personally oversee the investigation of who murdered Boris Nemtsov. And that's, of course, for any Russian, it just chills the blood, because we know when the head of state oversees the investigation, and I'm thinking particularly about Joseph Stalin and his investigation of murderers of the people he ordered to be killed, and then created them, turned them into martyrs, and actually allowed to prosecute even more people in the guise of protecting the state. So this is all very, very disturbing in terms of what Russia's future will hold and will look like.
So what do we know about Boris Nemtsov's girlfriend, the rather beautiful Ukrainian model who was with him when he was shot and has been held by the police ever since? She's apparently, at least her mother and others are saying, she's being held against her will. There's no way they can kind of scapegoat her, surely.
Well, they could easily scapegoat her. We don't know that. I mean, it's not much known. I mean, Nemtsov was an unmarried man, so obviously he would be allowed to have girlfriends and beautiful girlfriends. He was a very charming gentleman. I think the reason Nemtsov's murder hasn't been announced or brought to justice, and I'm very doubtful that people high up don't know who those were who shot at Nemtsov. It's just because killing somebody Friday night, Friday midnight next to the Kremlin, it's like broad daylight, because it's a lot of people. Every single square foot or square meter is should be documented. You can't even walk freely there if you can be suspected of some unlawful action. So this is very bizarre, I find. So I think what they're trying to to decide is how to spin the murder. And it is entirely possible that she, being Ukrainian, well, she infiltrated the opposition. And it was because already there was a conversation in the Russian press that it's the Western special forces, CIA, or Ukrainian government who wanted to get rid of Nemtsov so they could implicate Putin and blacken his reputation. So it was a a provocation against the Russian state. So the fact that the young woman was Ukrainian may serve this purpose really quite well.
And he was also about, was he not, about to, at this rally that he'd arranged for Sunday, at least
yes,
some reports that he was going to present evidence of Russian military involvement in Ukraine, which, of course, the government denies, and apparently they've been burying dead soldiers in the dead of night.
He was working on the report, and he was going to head that position, although unlike other people, other analysts, I actually don't think that Putin was entirely afraid of this, because the propaganda machine is so strong, and the national support is strong, so they could have spinned that report any way they wanted. And the way the spin would have worked is that since Nemtsov is pro-Ukrainian and in opposition to the Russian state, of course he is presenting evidence which is being bought by CIA. So that would have been quite easy. I think the more likely scenario is that the people now, because Putin really created an atmosphere of hatred, and so those who are not with us are against us, and therefore any way to eliminate an opponent becomes absolutely a legitimate way of fighting this war.
And he has referred to the opposition as a fifth column, which is about
exactly
as provocative as you can get.
Exactly. And Nemtsov was supposedly the leader of, one of the leaders of the fifth column. And of course, in a country like that or in atmosphere like that, you are completely in your right to eliminate those representatives of the fifth column. And I think that's where Putin's guilt is completely unsurmountable.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, where she has an article, Kremlin Murder Incorporated. And she's the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. So the dilemma that the West is faced with is, I don't think Putin cares about what the West thinks about him. The fact that he escaped culpability, at least nobody was able to pin the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner on him. He got beaten up by a lot of world leaders at the G20 recently in Australia and left early because he was isolated. Nobody would even sit with him at the lunch table. But I'm not sure that he cares about the isolation or the sanctions. So it's a difficult dilemma, but, you know, and he always refers to, or at least he often refers to Russia as a nuclear power with all of its nuclear weapons, which I think it has more than any other country, including the United States. You know, you obviously got to deal with this guy because of the potential for the relationship, which is already off the rails, getting incredibly much worse, and even the portent of a nuclear war is looming in the background. So how do you navigate between the fact that you have essentially a mafia don running a criminal state with nuclear weapons, at the same time you don't want another Cold War or a nuclear war?
Well, I think to start with categorizing him, I mean, you and I can talk about it, but officially categorizing him as a mafia state with being a criminal don probably is not a good way to go about it, because that's what Putin does not accept. He doesn't think the United States has the right to lecture him being having its own problems and issues. And one of the issues that he always cites is that, who is the United States to teach me how to run my affairs? Look at the United States. So I think there is a lot of ways to deal with him, although it is getting increasingly difficult. And I think unfortunately, as much as we want to, lecturing him on human rights, on international rights, probably is not going to be a good idea. I think it has to be very limited expectation of how a relationship with Russia would or could work. For example, if the say peace treaty truce between East Ukraine and Ukraine now seem to be somewhat holding. It's not holding exactly 100%, but somewhat. So actually, he expects to be recognized for that, and I'm afraid that this is probably the way to go. That all these little increments of success should be taken without expecting too much, because too much is not going to happen. We're already at the place of relationship where I don't think it's going to go back to normal, at least not in the near future. And so he needs to be dealt on with the environment that he presents. This is one thing I think is very important. So whatever the United States does or the West does, it has to be, the expectations have to be very realistic, and it's not much. Another thing that needs to be done, and it's really very important, is that the West needs to speak in unified voice. And so far, despite the encouragement and kind of America saying that they agreed with European actions, it's not true, because Europe itself is in disarray of how to deal with Putin. We have Viktor Orban of Hungary actually having relationship with Putin and wanting to get gas from him and whatnot. So there must be some sort of a conversation between European Union and America of how to deal with it. So I think these are the few first steps that are important. But expecting Russia to suddenly turn around and become the Western friend again, I don't think it's going to happen, because Putin does not back off. And at this time, he's so deep in hatred and national patriotism that he cannot turn around from that.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I recently spoke with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who military analyst, an independent military analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the few papers that Putin doesn't control.
Yet,
right. And I think as long as Gorbachev's alive, since Gorbachev's a shareholder, he probably won't take it over. But
we don't know.
You don't know.
We didn't think himself a politician. I mean, journalists, fine. I mean, not right. Fine, but they were killed. But, politician, it's a big deal when a politician is getting killed.
Sure. Well, but what he said, a couple of things that were interesting. One was that Putin himself is paranoid and believes the CIA is out to try and kill him. But two, he said that this military offensive against Ukraine, it was taken a little earlier, even though Russia has increased its defense spending this year by 30%. It's still way below the United States, of course. He was arguing that Putin is trying to build the military up. He has a long-term plan, and they're not quite there yet. And that to expect a much more aggressive and assertive Russia with much better military equipment. Clearly, at this point, they've been able to absolutely whip the Ukrainians, who clearly have old equipment and bad leadership. But the point he was making was that this military buildup has a purpose, and that is to intimidate the neighborhood.
I think so. No, I think it's absolutely correct. But it's not only. I mean, I think I would go even further. It's not just to intimidate the neighborhood, but it's also to make sure that Russia is not treated as the loser, because before it was two superpowers, and now Russia is no longer. What Putin is saying is that, fine, we're not making it yet as a superpower, but we're not going to let the United States to be the superpower alone. Whatever the United States does, we're just going to meddle with that, and we can. We're going to meddle in the world, and we can. And I think that's the bigger message. So Putin acts as he started as a smaller splinter with Syria when he was supporting Assad against everybody else. When they were Russia was dragging its feet with Iran and nuclear reactors there. But now it's a much larger splinter. It still acts like a splinter. And it really has been very successful in destabilizing not just Europe now already, but the whole global international environment. So absolutely, I think that's the plan. But we also have to remember that Putin's term in office is still another 10 years, 12 years, I don't remember exactly how many, 10 years, I think. And he's determined to stay on for this term. So he needs a paranoid Russia to maintain the vigilant view on enemies, so he can actually be that leader that Russia supposedly needs to stand against the enemies. He can't retire.
No, and I believe that he doesn't expect to retire except unwillingly on a gurney.
Well, but that's why he can't retire, because if he retires, it's going to be the end of him, and that's what he wants to prevent from happening. And war is the best way of doing that.
So then, just in closing, then we have a future here of I think the way you describe it is an even more dangerous new Cold War, given that you have this unusual hybrid of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons.
I think it is. I wouldn't call it the Cold War, though. I think we should find a better way of describing it, because if we talk about when we do the Cold War, when we use that term, we immediately think of past relationship, and it's really not the same anymore. I mean, we talked, I think you and I talked on this program a while ago, that it was probably a frozen peace, but I think now it's going further down the drain and it's frozen something. It's no longer even peace. It's sort of a frozen confrontation or something like that. Yes, I think it is. I think we should be really prepared for the future, which is not bright in any way. And, you know, of course, the death of Boris Nemtsov can go both ways. It can energize the opposition, and the opposition would grow larger and larger and larger. On the other hand, with a policy of intimidation, and Putin is very good at that, it could be used by the Kremlin as the new Great Purge, something that Joseph Stalin did in 1937, using his own political opponents as a reason why he needs to be vigilant. So we have two alternatives here, and regrettably, the Stalin alternative for me is probably a more viable understanding of how Putin will go.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and contributor to Project Syndicate, where she has a new article, Kremlin Murder Incorporated. She is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with a further examination of the real reasons behind the steep and sudden rise in the price of gas.
Когда придет дождь, тот, что уймет нас, когда уйдет тень над твоей землей, я проснусь здесь, пусть я проснусь здесь, в долгой траве, рядом с тобой.
Get from out the road when he get dull, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave of chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ball is pitching and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again and go up each time he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, Apple's thrilling in fear. And won't stop top ill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Wallace Turberville, a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Well, thank you so much, Ian, for having me.
And I'm trying to track down what's really behind the rise in gas prices. Here on the West Coast, gas has gone up 50 cents in a week. In a month, it's gone up a dollar. And the press keeps telling us it's about refinery fires and strikes, etc. But more and more, it seems apparent, particularly when I spoke with Michael Greenberger the other day, who was with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, it's to do with speculation. We've seen this bad movie before. So am I right in suggesting that the entire mainstream press is either drinking the Kool-Aid or just missing the 900-pound gorilla here?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, but certainly the gorilla is 900 pounds, and it's there. So there's no doubt that the particular way in the modern era that banks speculate is a cause, not exactly in that prices might go up, but in how far they might go up, and indeed how far they might go down at other times. So it's an accelerant of the any sort of movement in price.
Well, it seems, though, that there is a cause and effect here, that when that compromise funding bill, the must-pass funding bill, happened at the end of the year, mm-hmm. which a number of Democrats joined the Republicans in, and apparently there was a provision in there to undo a Dodd-Frank regulation that then allowed the banks to get back into speculating on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and that from that moment on, gas went way down, and now it's going way back. And
right. No, I think that's right. I think it's a question of how much prices move around, which is, of course, what really drives people to distraction and injures a lot of folks. By allowing the banks to continue to be part of the market, it's really damaging. You know, the banks don't just speculate in natural gas. They don't just speculate in gasoline or oil. They create synthetic, if you will, positions where it appears that they own those particular items. They don't actually own them. It's all synthetic. So they can have huge effects on that just multiply small consequences of supply and demand. If you're creating synthetic product, then you're disturbing the actual amount of demand or supply for these commodities, and it just causes small events to mushroom into much larger events.
So in other words, they can take positions and buy up contracts for, you know, billions of gallons of gasoline or crude oil and not have to put up any money?
They have to put up a little money, but not the price of the actual product. So these aren't real positions. They're positions that exist in cyberspace, if you will. And that's problematic. They did, and by the way, that's when when people talk about what happened in 2008 with the mortgages and with derivatives on top of actual mortgages, that's what was happening there. They created synthetic ownership kinds of interests, and that just multiplies many times what the actual consequences are, because it appears to the whole world that the actual amount of assets is much greater, or actually they can do it the opposite way, in a more complicated way, much smaller. But let's just think about it, much greater. So you can just mathematically multiply the consequences. That's good for traders because they like volatility, right? They like prices to move up and down a lot. If you're a trader looking at a screen and, you know, buying and selling, you want prices to move a lot because that means you can make a lot. But it's very bad for consumers.
So, again, I'm speaking with Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. And we're talking about what is really behind the sudden steep rise in gas after there was a moment a little over a month ago when people were enjoying the windfall of having extra cash in their pockets. And this is to do ultimately with the price of crude, which is still below $50 a barrel. So the market fundamentals are completely at odds with the price of gas, aren't they? I mean, the Saudis are dumping oil to eliminate the competition, and they said they're going to do it for a while. It may go on for a long time. We don't know. So there's a glut on the global market for oil, and yet the prices go up. So who's doing this?
Well, the small variations can occur over time. It's absolutely true that the glut, if you will continue, and that's going to be part of our economic landscape for quite a good period of time. The problem, of course, is with the speculation and the synthetic, manufacturing of what appears to be either people who want to buy or people who want to sell. That's all synthetic. Then what happens is a small event can turn into a large event, and it will appear like it's anomalous, like it doesn't make any sense. And in fact, it doesn't make any sense taking into consideration just how much oil is there, how much gasoline is there, and what's the demand. It doesn't make any sense on that basis, but it does make sense if you realize that there are these positions that aren't real, that are just that are just manufactured, and that just absolutely increases the consequences of a small effect. So it's an effect that you wouldn't even notice, that's just temporary, could turn into something that could cost people a lot of money, and has in the past, and probably is right now.
So in other words, a refinery fire here in Los Angeles can be blown up into a much bigger event, at least in terms of the price. So, but at the end of the day, you would think, this is the way that I see it, and I'm just trying to look at this objectively, Wallace Turberville, that the banking lobby, which, they bought a bunch of Congress people, most of the Republicans and a bunch of Democrats, to change the rules on Dodd-Frank in a must-pass spending bill at the end of the year, which is a number of lame duck Democrats voted for, and then they were then able to get back into the commodities future trading market on oil derivatives and other commodities. And from that moment onward, suddenly the price and gas went way down and then went way back up again. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that there's a real cause and effect there. And my question to you would be, what kind of a Congress do we have? These are not people that are representing the people's interests. Because the people's interests in this case are absolutely diametrically opposed to the interests of the five big banks who are speculating and making money at the expense of the American consumer.
Well, the power of the banks is enormous. If they're spending billions of dollars every year in trying to get political results, they'll tend to do so. I think you're right. I think in terms of I think Senator Durbin once said in an incautious moment, the banks buy and sell us.
They own this place. He was talking about the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Yeah, they own this place, I think is what he said.
Yeah, so that's all true. I just wish more people could actually see what I see on a daily basis and trying to get some movement in terms of regulation and preserve at least some of what Dodd-Frank did. The attacks on Dodd-Frank are going to be repeated and ubiquitous, at least for the next 2 years, and maybe even worse if the election goes a certain direction in 2016. And it's become clear. I mean, the last offering Congress made before the new one came in was Dodd-Frank, and the first one when as soon as they showed up was Dodd-Frank. So that's something they want to do, and they want to do it for primarily for because of the influence of the banks.
So since, Wallace Turberville, since you were an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, and the mechanism by which these big banks buy commodities and trade on these futures on oil and grain, et cetera, is called the Goldman Sachs Index. Mm-hmm. So walk us through that. How does it actually work?
Well, the Goldman Sachs Index is, they actually sold it, so it's not operated by them anymore, but I think they sold it once they set it up to so that they wouldn't be criticized. But it's as I described, it's a way where they can go to customers and primarily large institutional investors, and they can sign. They can write a series of contracts where Goldman Sachs will give the customer essentially the by just paying money in and taking money out the consequences of changes in the price of a commodity like oil. So from a financial perspective, the customer, and that's what the Goldman Sachs Index is. It measures the payments going back and forth. So from the customer standpoint, the customer will experience the actual changes in oil, natural gas, corn, wheat, a number of different kinds of commodities, and it's as if the customer actually owned the commodity itself, but they're not storing, you know, bushels of wheat or barrels of oil or, you know, million BTUs of natural gas. They're just experiencing the economic consequences. The problem, of course, from the market's perspective is that what the market sees as these positions are traded around, it looks like they actually exist. And that can be very misleading to the marketplace, and it has the effect of making a small move look big, which is what I was describing earlier. It's precisely how that it gets affected. And the Goldman Sachs Index is the methodology for calculating what the payments are that create this synthetic ownership interest.
But my understanding was that Dodd-Frank specifically wanted to get the big banks out of the commodities trading, because the whole purpose of commodities trading is for the end users. In other words, airlines who have a great interest in the price of gas are able to buy futures and get contracts. And then, say the Pillsbury that uses wheat and other grains, they have an interest in price stability and hedging against, you know, climate anomalies or whatever. That's my understanding is the original purpose for the Commodities Futures Trading Exchange. The Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act got the big banks out of this new casino they were playing around with, which is pretty much exclusive to them. And then the Congress at the end of the last year allowed them to get back in and look. We've seen the results almost immediately.
Yeah. See, what the Dodd-Frank Act did was sort of accomplished it in an indirect way, which is unfortunate, right? Because again, even when the Dodd-Frank Act was going through Congress, there was a lot of influence being brought to bear by the banking industry. So instead of saying you just can't do it, they said, oh, you could do it, but you have to move it into a subsidiary that's separate and capitalized. So, in fact, the bank wouldn't be doing it, but a subsidiary would be. And the idea would be if anything went wrong, they could shut down the subsidiary. But that was one of the prime targets that the financial lobby wanted to go after. As soon as its strength grew to the point where they could actually effectively do that, and that's what they did. So they, even that, which was not the best way to address it, I mean, it's out of the bank, but it's in a related company, and it was even weakened further, and as the statute was put through, even that, what I would call a relatively weak way to keep the banks out of this business was one of the prime targets when the new Congress came in, and they got it through. And what's unfortunate is that the administration, who should be thinking of Dodd-Frank as one of its two or three most important accomplishments, let it go because they were afraid of the potential for government shutdowns and the continuing sort of gridlock that's associated with that. So they traded it, and that's just, in my view, that's too bad. But they did it, and people like Senator Elizabeth Warren, of course, were just aghast by that, but it didn't stop it from occurring during the holiday season just before the first of the year, and that's exactly what happened.
And even Nancy Pelosi, I think, was appalled too, didn't she?
Yeah, she was too. She let's give her credit too. She was definitely concerned about the whole thing. And it went through. It was a trade-off, and that's unfortunate because these things cost the people a lot of money. And you know, and obviously, you know, government shutdowns and speculating in oil, gasoline and natural gas aren't related, except in these kinds of circumstances where it just becomes a total horse trade.
But just to be clear about what happened, at the behest of the banking lobby representing the big banks, mm-hmm. the new Congress, before they even came into office, just before the end of the year, mm-hmm. pushed through this change in Dodd-Frank that allowed the banks to get back, you know, feet first into trading commodities and profiting from them. And because the White House didn't want to veto it because it was a must-pass spending bill and would have otherwise shut the government down, they went along with it. Enough Democrats went along with the full Republican majority to pass it. And as a result, the American consumer got screwed. So in other words, every time you go to the pump, whatever premium you're paying now above what you were paying a little while ago is going directly into the pockets of the essentially this parasitic operation that has nothing to do with the commodity itself and the real market forces determining its price. It's just pure internal casino that our Congress allowed. So again, it's pretty stark, isn't it, that these people in Congress represent the moneyed interests, that powerful interests at the expense of the people it's supposed to represent, which are ordinary American citizens who are getting gouged at the pump.
Yeah, and it's a tragic set of circumstances because, as you might have gathered from the way I described it with, you know, words like synthetic and those sorts of things, and indexes and that sort of thing, it's really hard for the regular worker, the people who are listening to your program. It's really hard for them to understand how it all works. The people who understand it are the banks and the big oil companies and big energy companies, and they have no interest in having anything other than this to go forward. So that's part of the, you know, it's like bills passed in the dead of night. Those are problematic. Well, bills passed without a full discourse over exactly what's going on, that's bad too. And that's sort of where we are, and that's one of the things that led to this particular situation. And that's just too bad because you're right, the people pay, and they don't know why they're paying. And
the press doesn't tell them.
The press is hobbled because they, you know, I mean, they're, mm. they it's hard for them to know because there's very little of a constituency to actually explain what's going on. Mm. But there are some, very few, but there are some people in some journalists who actually try to understand that, and that's good, but not nearly enough.
Well, Wallace Turberville, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. And then he joined Better Markets, where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Future Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.